Move that mask because your voice is incredibly muffled.
Really? Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you for being with us. So, guys, today's episode, we're going to be talking about something that really hit me in the feels. I read it and I was like, this is something I definitely want to talk to. Okay, let me just hit you with this sentence, right? Pain is certain, suffering is optional.
Whoa.
What does that mean?
Let that sink in.
What does that mean? Can you give us some examples? Give us some examples for the listeners too.
Yeah, like if somebody punches you in the face, the pain is certain, but the suffering, you don't have to suffer.
You don't have to suffer. Just because pain, I feel...
Give me examples.
Yeah, that wasn't a good example, was it?
I think our listeners need examples for this one.
Suffering is a choice that I make. It's a reaction, okay, that I have toward any occurrence in my life. Pain is certain. Some things are going to...
Hurt
real bad, like a punch in the face, getting my tooth pulled out,
somebody being mean to you, but don't you suffer?
Are they not together simultaneously?
No, that's on you.
Right.
Whether you want to take that pain, if you look at it as a process of growth, if you look at it as something that is good for you, I got that tooth pulled out because had I not done that, it would have rot and it would have, you know, the rest of my teeth would have rot and this and that. When I look at it like that, the suffering goes away. I'm like,
but you're in pain.
You might be in pain
for the coming week.
She's talking about suffering as a kind of mentality.
It's the place you are up here in your brain.
Let's think of it as opposite of thankfulness.
Suffering
would be like you just got some pain, and then instead of
let's give some practical examples in the society. Like someone comes up and is very rude towards you.
Yeah.
You feel this pain.
So
you want to give back.
What do you do now? Suffering would be like going, they did something bad to me.
And dwelling on it.
And you're letting
feeling bad.
Yeah, feeling bad and just being like, and then the next
negativity.
The next person you meet, you're just like, you know what happened? Somebody was mean to me.
And project that.
And you have this grudge.
Yeah,
this grudge within you for months.
Suffering.
So you decide not to have that grudge within you.
Right.
At that moment, you just cut that grudge.
They hurt you, and then what are you going to do? You're going to be like...
You just leave it there.
Good. I got hurt today. Oh, yeah.
I'm growing.
So when we say it's optional, we just leave it there.
Huh?
Is that right, Shay?
Let it go.
You just let it go.
I'm just discussing this, man.
I think that's exactly what it is, bro. Because it was beautifully put by the little charade you guys played out there. Something happens to you, and the way I analyze it and decide to react to it, that person hurt me, they said something really hurtful to me, I can either say, yes, the pain was there. You recall a failure, right? Last year, sometime around here, I failed miserably at a project, right? I can constantly look back at that project and feel a sense of failure hurts. I never fail. I'm Zainab, supposedly. Not to pat myself on the back, but pat. But I tell myself that I could think about, I was so embarrassed. It was so horrible. All that time and energy wasted. What if they don't hire me again? Or I can say, I learned something from this. It was a great experience.
Right.
I exhausted all the options, but it didn't work out.
I would use this experience for the future.
There we go. So how many times have you experienced something like that?
A lot.
Tell me about times that you felt you don't need to suffer from a pain.
I don't need to suffer from a pain?
Yeah.
I'm
going to move out of the suffering space and grow.
Ooh.
Make it turn into something
now,
positive.
Now
okay, tell me. Yeah.
So basically a person came up once and was very rude and, you know, said many things. It happens in different situations, you know. And I just decided not to answer back, but with a smile. And then secondly, you do not talk about that incident. If you want to talk about it with your close ones and your relatives, your friends, you just hurt them too. All right. If you need to release yourself, all right, you talk about it once thoroughly, and then you leave it at that moment, as we talked about with Sheikh. You leave it at that moment, at that incident, and then that's it. You don't talk about it anymore, all right? And you just let it go. You concentrate on the now, the power of now. That's the technique I use, basically. You talk about it thoroughly, and then you let it go.
Yeah,
you start with a new chapter of your life. When you continue to talk about that incident over and over again with your close ones, with yourself,
your
mind,
right.
That is just negativity.
Mm. Yeah.
That is toxic for you. That's venomous.
Stop playing it back in your head.
Just injecting
over and over
that venom in your body. And that mind activity that you have, that just takes away all your energy. You feel tired and you haven't done anything.
That is so true.
Off the back of that, that's a very good piece of advice, actually, to talk about it thoroughly once.
Once and for all.
Your mind needs to process it and need
closure.
To kind of
I think
complain
you need
to somebody.
Too.
Some people need to complain to their spouse or their friends or whoever, right? But, you know, you can actually do it to Allah as well. The point is you actually get it out of your system. People think that they're strong enough to keep it inside. You're not.
You need an outlet. You need to vent. The human heart is so fragile. As strong as it is, it's so fragile and it's so delicate that you can't constantly burden it with these things.
Now, I have the technique, if you could call it a technique, to talk with that person directly. I prefer not to talk with close ones or family members. Why? Because they are just making them upset.
Yes,
I'm just making them sad. So you talk with that person, you release yourself, talk thoroughly, and then that's it. It's over with.
What did I want to tell
you? But then you have people who have that grudge within themselves years.
Mm.
Years. Mm. They just have that grudge, you know, haven't released it. And they have talked about it over and over again. Does it sound familiar?
Mm.
So we need to get rid of that kind of, when you talk about it all the time.
Negative energy?
That negative energy, yeah.
Brother Muzaffar, can you think of any other solutions for this scenario?
Yes, sister. I call it the SpongeBob SquarePants solution, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to be an idiot.
Yes.
Sometimes the problem is you're too clever and you know that you've just been attacked.
Mm.
You know that this person has just made a snide remark towards you. You know that this person is doing something intentionally to try to make themselves look better than you in front of others, or, you know, loads of different scenarios. You got to be SpongeBob SquarePants.
When he's facing Squidward
is always rude and nasty and mean to SpongeBob. What does SpongeBob do? He's oblivious. He doesn't even know. And so what happens is the best things always end up happening.
You're ignoring, basically.
When you say
ignore that person's comments,
isn't the right word, because ignoring is something that your parents tell you when you're being bullied in school or something, and then you're like, you can't ignore it. It's right in front of your face. I'm not even saying to ignore it. I'm saying to accept it.
Make the best out of it.
Accept it, but pretend that you didn't realize it. So, yeah, I mean, it is kind of ignoring it.
Yeah, it is. Accept it. Recognize it.
Right.
And then let it go.
Pretend it's not what it is.
Could I explain it in this way? Accept it. Recognize it, embrace it, and then let it go.
Look, often these things happen with your Muslim brethren, right?
Absolutely.
What does Islam tell you to do when it comes to your Muslim brethren? That you need to be merciful amongst them, and you need to give them loads and loads of benefits of the doubt. Mm. So many benefits. I'm literally saying, don't even ignore it. Just be an idiot.
Right. You know
just
someone blatantly insulted you, but you go like, oh, that was so funny the way he was so sarcastic. Right.
I don't agree with you.
In some certain situations, it really does help.
I wouldn't laugh or smile like that, or I wouldn't pretend to be an idiot. I would go with that strategy to recognize it.
Mm.
That was a comment to me. Recognize it, embrace it, and let it go. Or talk with that person.
Sometimes when you are in a discussion with someone and they constantly make snide comments at you, doing that to them, ignoring them, kind of makes them feel like...
Squidward. They use Squidwardify then.
They feel that extreme, excessive positive projection of energy makes them feel stupid and it disarms them.
And it's happened
to me so often. Like even in the studio with some guests, they're trying to put me down at a point that I'm trying to make, and I'm going like, after a while, they think like, okay, maybe I should stop bugging her because she just doesn't get it.
Yeah, and they actually think, huh, maybe I was just being nice and funny.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it just gets
repelled. It's reverse psychology.
Now, I want to go off.
Oh, it's reverse psychology.
I want to go off of Waheed's point. Brother Waheed, it's true. Sometimes you need to pay attention. But see, now when do we need to pay attention? when there's a genuine threat, where somebody is going to attack you, for example, or your dean, for example,
religion,
you know, something,
especially
there's something
your
major
religion.
Happening, right? So this is
so
often,
if it's a minor thing, don't
it's
bother.
Often with the non-Muslims that this happens. But I'm talking about like Muslims and with family members. There are so many snide remarks. There are so many negative things that people say. If you just become SpongeBob with the mu'mineen, you're going to be cool. And it's not going to hurt you anymore, right?
But if
just
you're
in one ear and out from the other ear.
Yes, there we go. In one ear and out through the other. Another aspect or another arena that I feel we obey Allah, the concept of obeying Allah because I don't want to suffer in hell, rather than obeying Him because He deserves to be obeyed. If we would rather tell ourselves that we should obey Allah because He deserves to be obeyed, because He gives so much rahmah to us, rather than focusing on the suffering part, that no, I don't want to go to hell and suffer all of eternity. That's why in the beginning of the show, when we talked about suffering being a place you're at in your mind, it's a mentality.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that that's a mentality we should project onto our relationship with Allah as well. Not to focus so much on the suffering part.
You mean that we shouldn't focus so much on the negativity, the suffering part, hell. We should focus on the positivity, paradise, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Right. That is, I agree with you 100%. And there's another aspect to it. When we feel anger, anxiety, I don't know, we're just agitated, we're upset, whatever, you need to deal with those emotions of yours. That is suffering. You're suffering mentally within yourself. You need to fix those issues. I mean, our outer world or exterior world reflects our inner world, right? So if we have troubles or issues within ourselves, psychological issues, we need to fix and solve those issues. And when whatever we see in our outer world, our exterior world, it reflects our inner world.
Absolutely.
Have that key principle in your mind.
Exactly.
Why
if you're
are these
for
obstacles
a red car,
coming in my way? Why is this happening at my job? Why is this happening with my family? Well, how are you within yourself?
If you're constantly looking for a red car, all you see on the street is red cars.
Okay. I just want to have 2 points here. Number one, looking at the negative side, the hell, the punishment, and looking at the positive side, I think it really does vary from person to person. Because
the typology.
And Imam Khomeini has talked about this as well, where he says that, you know, different people get attracted to Allah through different ways. And it just, that's just the natural way it is. Some people, no matter how much you talk to them about heaven and, you know, paradise and the positive things, they won't pray unless they, you know, they get told
they're
that, by the way, you're going to go to
the
hell
whip.
If you don't do
they
this.
They need the
okay,
whip.
I'll do it now, you know. There's some people who are just like that. And the second thing is that, look, this a lot of these thoughts that come to us, it's not our thoughts at all. The things that we suffer because of, remember Shaitan, if he can't cause you to, you know, go astray in your deen and stuff like that, he just wants you to suffer. And so what these Shayateen will do is they will continuously put foul thoughts into your mind. They insulted you. They hurt you. You know, your rights are being taken away. This is horrible. How can you let them do this to you? Just recognize that those thoughts are coming from an external force. We often trick ourselves into thinking that, no, it's all coming from within. But actually, no, if we recognize that Shaitan does exist and he's speaking to us, he's whispering to us from an unknown place, we can also learn to repel that and it will get rid of a lot of this suffering.
That was wonderful. Thank you so very much for being with us, brothers and sisters, on this episode of Back to Reality. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
ministry election, the U.S. presidential candidates were vocal on important foreign policy issues in the Middle East, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Palestine. But debate was visibly absent on one critical issue, Iraq. It remains unclear the kind of approach the U.S. administration will adopt in the Middle East, and more particularly on Iraq. But President-elect Joe Biden has a long history of involvement in the oil-rich country, with a controversial track record since the early 2000s. And so, while Iraqi leaders, including Iraqi President Barham Saleh and Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, congratulated Joe Biden soon after the announcement of his victory, Baghdad remains cautious of the relations ahead. As chair of the U.S. Senate in 2002, Biden voted for a resolution that led to the U.S. invasion of Iraq a year later. He also served as vice president to Obama, playing a key role in the drawdown of 150,000 American troops from the country in 2011. Although many supported the move at the time, it was intentional to create a security vacuum that paved the way for the rise of Daesh. By 2014, the Takfiri group occupied large swaths of Iraqi territory, a development that, surprise, surprise, brought U.S. occupation forces back to the country as part of an international coalition to supposedly fight Daesh. However, Biden is mostly known for co-authoring a controversial 2006 article that called for the division of Iraq along ethnic and religious lines. Seen as a plan to divide and further deepen sectarian divisions in Iraq, the proposal was badly received in Baghdad. This makes us wonder how Baghdad will receive it again when Biden is sworn in as president and ready to implement his plan of dividing Iraq. It would also mean active involvement of U.S. occupation troops in facilitating the new U.S. plan to divide the country. However, it's 2020, not 2006 anymore. Iraq's popular mobilization units, Hashd al-Shaabi, have made it clear that in the event the U.S. defies Iraqi law by extending its illegal stay, then the Hashd al-Shaabi will have no other option but to confront the force of occupation. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iraq did not feature in the U.S. 2020 election campaign, but is likely to be a permanent file on Joe Biden's desk. Biden backed the U.S. invasion in 2003 before changing his mind. Now, as vice president to Barack Obama, he was involved in the decision to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq, which he saw as an opportunity to atone from his earlier mistake. However, Biden had proposed a plan in 2006 to divide Iraq into three Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish regions, believing that this would allow U.S. forces to leave Iraq by 2008. This time, he plans to make it happen. To discuss with us this issue from Beirut is Mr. Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. Now, the Iraqi file has been stressing nearly all U.S. presidents for years now. Biden has visited Iraq more than 27 times and is familiar with the contents of the file as well as the Iraqi politicians. Now, on what grounds does he really think that dividing Iraq according to sectarian and religious lines would actually help the country rather than just weaken it more?
He doesn't really care about helping the country. What he cares about is American supremacy in the region, and that can only be achieved by breaking up the national states in the Arabic world into fractured mini-states that are constantly at war with each other around ethnic and religious or sectarian lines. So this is not a new plan. This has been the plan since before World War I in terms of breaking up the old Ottoman domain into those fractured identities that cannot coagulate together to form a state that can be sovereign or independent of Western imperialism. And it will continue, this plan. This is the only way that the West can guarantee its control of the region.
Well, Laith, Biden must truly understand that Iraq today is different from the Iraq that he knew, especially the one where he decided to present a platform or a plan in the U.S. to divide the country into three semi-autonomous regions. America itself is at a defining moment in Iraq controlling no territory or very specific territory, having no influence or unable even to intervene in political decision-making process. They are regularly being threatened by the popular mobilization units for a confrontation, especially in the event that the U.S. does not actually abide by the withdrawal timetable set by the Iraqi parliament for them to leave the country. How do you see the Iraqi factions reacting to Biden's plan if he really has it in mind to be implemented in Iraq?
Well, the last time the United States attempted to do that with the referendum in Iraq, Kurdistan province, we saw the response, the immediate response from the government of Iraq, from the factions in Iraq, and even from the government of Iran and Turkey. Within hours of that referendum, all the entrances and exits to Kurdistan were, you know, taken over by the Iraqi army and the Iranian army, and that ended it, that possibility of separation. So the West can dream as much as they want of fracturing Arab societies and countries further, but that plan is gone, long gone. The power to do so that may have existed around World War I, even maybe after the end of the Soviet Union, is gone now. The United States has burnt all its cards, all its games have been played out and didn't work out, and everybody knows these plots and plans by heart. Everybody has memorized what the United States is trying to do, and it's not going to work out.
So you think Biden might actually have another option on the table here?
Well, the option that we see the United States in general, whether it's Biden or Trump in power, is confrontation with Iran. They've tried to fracture the Iraqi society since the 1990s, mm-hmm. and it didn't work out. They tried invading, defeating Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it didn't work out. They tried invading and fracturing Syria, and it didn't work out. So now the only thing that they have in front of them is to have a confrontation with Iran, which is also not going to work out.
Well, from what you just said, one of the game changers in Iraq that Biden is actually hoping for to reach is a new agreement with Iran, where one of the concessions will be for Iran to reduce its influence in Iraq, meaning to stop its support to the popular mobilization forces, the only viable force against ISIS, which was able to defeat ISIS in Iraq and help also the Syrian Arab Army on the border to rid both countries from these terrorists, these Western-backed terrorists, if I may. But come on now, I mean, he would seriously ask them that, the Iranians, I mean, especially after Donald Trump assassinated one of the most important men in Iran, Lieutenant General Martyr Qasem Soleimani, at the beginning of 2020?
It's wishful thinking that to think that you can ask Iran to give up on its principled position of support for Palestinian liberation, for Arab sovereignty, for Muslim unity, in return for a few dollars in trade. You know, they've asked that to the smaller factions of the resistance accents. We've seen them try to do that with Hezbollah, and, you know, Hezbollah refusing to give up its principle. We've seen how Syria was, you know, offered the moon and the stars and the sun by the imperialists if they give up on Palestine, on the resistance in Lebanon, and in their relationship with Iran. And 10 years of war on Syria, still Syria refuses to give up on its principles. So it is wishful thinking to think that Iran will give up on the principles of justice, equality, and liberation for a few measly dollars.
Well, it's also very important to talk about the factor that is always being pushed away by the U.S., which is the popular mobilization forces and the threats that they have been issuing against the U.S. occupation troops in Iraq especially for the past two months. I mean, they are constantly threatening them not to play games with the Iraqi decision to withdraw their troops from Iraq. Do you think we are maybe moving closer towards a full-fledged confrontation with the U.S. Army, between the U.S. Army and the Iraqi PMU when Biden takes office? In the meantime, there are people who are saying it's going to happen even earlier than that, when even Trump is still there.
This is now a very dangerous time frame that we have from now till inauguration in the early January of the president, whichever president comes in. We know that
they're not sure if it's Biden or Trump.
It's very unsure. You know, maybe Trump is going to bring in the army on the streets and stay in power. But to come back to the issue of Iraq, you know, we've seen how the Pentagon and hierarchy within the American military were basically lying to Trump about the numbers of troops in Syria. They've lied to him about withdrawals. And what does that tell you? That tells you that no matter who is the president of the United States, the deep state that controls the actual decisions is the one that makes the shots. So it doesn't matter what Biden wants. It doesn't matter what Trump wants.
It's the real president, the Pentagon and the CIA.
Exactly. So the deep state, the military complex, the imperialist power of America speaks above and beyond any president.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Leif Maluf, political commentator, for talking to us about the possibility of an actual confrontation between the forces, legal forces in Iraq, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and the U.S. occupation troops in the event they don't leave and in the event Biden decides to divide Iraq. I want to thank you very much for your contribution. And please stay tuned. We will talk next about Syria and the sanctions that are preventing refugees to return to their country. Stay with us. Syrian President Bashar Assad declared last week that the Syrian government is working to secure the return of millions of refugees who fled war in their country. But Western sanctions are hindering the work of state institutions, hence complicating those plans. President Assad said millions of refugees were being forced to stay in host countries by pressure or intimidation, and that host states were enticing them financially while benefiting from international aid on their behalf. West preventing refugees from returning to Syria in this following report.
Syrian President Bashar Assad announced last week that the Syrian government is working to secure the return of millions of refugees who fled war in their country. But Western sanctions are hindering the work of state institutions and complicating those plans. President Assad's comments came at the opening session of a two-day international conference in Damascus on the return of refugees. The event was boycotted by many Western countries who blatantly say the time is not ripe yet for the return of refugees. They insist the first priority should be to make it safe for people to go back to the war-torn country. These Western countries that have been funding extremism in Syria since 2011 seem to have forgotten that the Syrian Arab Army have recaptured much of Syria from their proxy terrorists, with the backing of other allies like Russia and Iran, which helped rid the country from complete chaos. Neighboring Turkey, a main backer of proxy Takfiri armed groups in Syria, was not invited to the conference. Another neighbor, Jordan, which also hosts Syrian refugees, did not participate. Lebanon's outgoing foreign minister, Sherb El-Wehbi, addressed the gathering by video conference and used the opportunity to call on the international community to help in the return of Syrian refugees. Lebanon is hosting the highest per capita number of Syrian refugees, who at one point made up nearly a quarter of the tiny country's population of 5 million. The country is now mired in an unprecedented economic and financial crisis. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, whose speech was read by the Russian president's envoy to Syria, described the sanctions as financial strangulation used to prevent the arrival of foreign aid and put up obstacles to prevent the return of the displaced to areas under government control. President Assad emphasized during his speech that the European and U.S. sanctions on his government hinder rebuilding efforts and improvement of infrastructure that was damaged by the war, which doesn't help the return of refugees.
now with us from Damascus to discuss the issue of Western countries not allowing refugees to go back to their country is Vanessa Bailey, independent journalist and photographer. Thank you for being with us, Vanessa. Now, over the past few years, Syria has succeeded in achieving the return of hundreds of thousands of refugees back home, and the government is still working relentlessly for the return of each refugee who is willing to participate in rebuilding his country. However, some regional and Western countries are impeding their return home, with more than 70% of Syria now free and safe for their return. It's free from the terrorism that the West already harbored. Why would those countries hinder the return of the Syrian refugees home?
Well, I think because to a large degree that would mean normalization of their relationships with Syria. Of course, they basically want to maintain the propaganda, which of course manufactures consent for the so-called humanitarian war against Syria. And therefore, to see from a propaganda point of view, to see refugees returning home in their droves is not acceptable to the US coalition, to the US alliance, which of course is also backed heavily, and the intelligence operations are backed heavily by the UK. So the last thing they want to see are these refugees going back to Syria, because that would also mean that to a large degree they had to accept their defeat, both from a military perspective but also from an information war perspective.
Well, we did hear Syrian President Bashar Assad blaming the United States of America for hampering the return of refugees to Syria, citing the continuous U.S. sanctions as one of the main hurdles in doing so. Can you explain how the U.S. sanctions actually intimidate Syrian refugees from returning home to help rebuild the country?
Well, I think if we consider the sanctions to be part of the U.S. hybrid war strategy, which of course has been part of the war waged against Syria from 2011, and this includes not only the sanction regime, which of course was increased to an even more sadistic level with the imposition of the seizure law sanctions earlier this year based on the fraudulent report commissioned by Qatar. Qatar, of course, is one of the major backers and sponsors of the terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda inside Syria. And so not only economically are things being made very, very difficult for people to return, but of course we've seen this year the burning of crops both by Israel and by America, by the American troops, by the American proxies, the burning of plantations, the burning of olive groves, the burning of cotton plantations deliberately by possible affiliates of the armed groups. And of course, the armed groups are the proxies of the U.S. coalition inside Syria. We've seen the occupation, the ongoing occupation of the oil fields, which of course is, it's not so much the revenue that's coming in from those oil fields, it's the prevention of the oil reaching the Syrian civilians. And that, of course, is increasing the electricity problems, the fuel problems, the gas and essential infrastructure problems. So it's not only sanctions. It's an entire raft of measures and strategies by the U.S. coalition to keep Syria in this insecure state. Really sorry about them.
No worries. Actually, I love your dogs and I appreciate them having the time to be along with us. No worries at all. But while the U.S. relations with Iran, Turkey, and Russia, and obviously the Israeli regime could all have reverberations in Syria, Biden seems unlikely to expend political capital there as per his position on the war on Syria. Does this maybe signal some sort of a possible change of attitude towards the Syrian government that the U.S. administration during both the Obama and the Trump administration had against the government in Syria and the Syrian president?
I think the problem is with Biden is that you're going back to almost default position. You're going back to an Obama position. If you look at the proposed administration of Biden, you have some of the most historically aggressive war hawks in his administration. You have what is effectively a bipartisan war party under Biden, with a clear ambition to destroy Russia, to destroy Chinese, as they say, expansionism. And therefore, of course, Syria will be caught in those crosshairs. You have Biden effectively putting out statements that he wants the U.S. military to be the greatest force again in the world. You have him, of course, demanding the strengthening of NATO. So you have someone now in power, and I don't even consider Biden to be the real power. Of course, who I consider to be the power are those behind the election of Biden. And those include Dick Cheney, John Negroponte, of course, who was instrumental in leading the war against Iraq in 2003 based on the weapons of mass destruction. So you have effectively a transversal war party under Biden, and unfortunately I think that signals potential greater military intervention in Syria on the basis of pushing back against, as part of the Cold War strategy against Russia and against Chinese expansionism.
You see, Vanessa, the observers of the Syrian domestic politics have noted that Trump's Syria policy had actually succeeded in turning President Assad's triumph into an actual disaster, ensuring that Syria remained restive by stopping the funds the Syrian government needed for reconstruction after huge swaths of the country's infrastructure had been destroyed because of the war that was backed by the West against Syria. Now, what are the options left here for the Syrian government to try and reboot the country's economy and mainly just begin the process of reconstruction here?
I think while I agree that Trump has been far from, let's say, sympathetic to the Syrian cause, I think when you compare Trump and Biden, you're not comparing the same people. Trump didn't, but one wonders to what extent the influence for his actions on that has come from the deep state that, of course, are now pushing Biden into position. But I think all that Syria can do, which is what it has been doing, is, if you like, to pivot towards Russia, towards Iran, and towards China, and to use the countries that are prepared to trade with Syria to circumvent the sanctions, like, for example, Venezuela, Cuba, even South Africa. The South African embassy has remained open in Syria during the entire conflict. And we know that South Africa itself, or the ambassador here, is trying to further economic relations between South Africa and Syria and to open up business opportunities here. So we, you know, Syria has to recognize its true allies and to work with those, as I said, who are also all suffering from American sanctions, and to create an environment in which trade can be participated in by those nations, by those non-aligned nations, in order to squeeze out the American supremacists, because that's effectively what it is. Of course, it's an economic hegemony that America is trying to maintain, and that Biden, for certain, will continue to try to maintain. So I don't think we should see it as a Trump policy or an Obama policy or a Biden policy. It's a deep state policy. It's a U.S. policy, and it will be maintained by whoever the president is, incoming or outgoing.
I want to thank you very much, Vanessa Beely, independent journalist and photographer, for joining us from Damascus to talk about how the West is actually hindering the return of Syrian refugees back to their hometown, back to their homeland in Syria, to try and rebuild the country. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listener of Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As we continue in our series that we began looking at the 10 Islamic commandments for a healthy life, and so we continue in our discussion by looking at the second commandment of the 10 that we want to cover. And that is the commandment to be good to our parents. Whatever they do, the sins that our parents do, that's between them and Allah. If you as a young man or woman cannot encourage the good, cannot forbid the evil, cannot help your parents out of that situation, their accountability is with Allah. But our accountability is with our parents. We still respect them. And actually, it's such at such a level where at the time of one of the latter khalifas of the Banu Abbas, the Abbasid dynasty, one of the khalifas who was, obviously, and they were all corrupt, Banu Umayyah, Banu Abbas, there were very few people who were in charge of authority that were good people. Other than Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, all the other khulafa were pretty much corrupt. One of the latter khulafa, Banu Abbas, he had a son, he had multiple sons, but one of the children was a respectable man. He loved the Ahlul Bayt. He detested to hear his father curse Amir al-Mu'mineen, as was the tradition of those khalifas, so-called khalifas. They would insult the Ahlul Bayt, they would curse the family of the Prophet. They didn't think anything about it. But this one man had a bit of a sense of understanding that what his father was doing was not right. And he hated to hear his father curse Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he went to the Imam, he's either the 7th or the 8th Imam, or maybe the 9th Imam, and he told the Imam of the situation. He says that this is what my father is doing. He's the Khalifa, but he's also my father. What do I do about it? Can I kill my father? And the Imam was telling the man, he says, of course you can't kill your father. At the end of the day, he's still your father. However evil and wicked and corrupt this man is, you can't kill him. But he pressured the Imam. He kept asking and asking and asking the Imam, this is what my father says, this is what my father does. He's literally outside of the fold of Islam. And the Imam says, you know what, if you need to do it, go ahead, but realize that one of the outcomes of doing this act is that you are going to shorten your lifespan. Because there is a rule in Islam of cause and effect. Just like in the world, right, you throw something up in the air, it'll come back down. It's a rule that God has put in, gravity. There's a rule that if you respect your parents, you'll live a long life. There's a rule that God has put in the physics and the mechanics of this world, in the spiritual realm of this world. You do good to your parents, you'll get it back, right? What they call karma in this society. But you don't do good to your parents, even if they're wicked, you'll still pay the price. Even if what you're doing can be sanctioned by the religion. So the story goes that he killed the father, he took over the throne. He didn't last for more than a few months and he was dethroned and he himself was killed. But he did what his responsibility was. Now don't go and do this at home, right? This is a man going to the Imam of his time, the representative of Allah, so he had sanctioned by the Imam. We don't have that, right? So we have to deal with our parents, young or old, whatever they are, in ways that we have been learned, we have been taught from the Quran and the hadith of Ali Muhammad alayhi wassalatu wassalam. Let me just give you one other story about the level of parents, right? Just to show us, before I go more into this, the role that parents have in our lives. When you look at the role of the mother, she carries the baby, the child, the fetus in her womb. And she goes through the difficulties of not only childbirth, but you know, sleepless nights and not being able to function normally during the pregnancy. It's a difficult time for women, for most women. And then after the birth of the child, most of us who are fathers in this room, we probably sleep through the child's first few months. Right? We're sleeping while our wife is awake feeding and changing the diapers and taking care of our children. And we men have it easy most of the times. But one time a man comes to the 6th Imam, Imam As-Sadiq, peace be upon him. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And he had just performed the Hajj. And I'm sure many of you have performed Hajj. You know today how easy it is. Everything's air conditioned. You have water everywhere. You have McDonald's. If you want to grab a bite from Burger King or KFC. But back then in the day, it wasn't that easy. This man does the Hajj with his mother on his shoulders. Can you imagine? Right? Today, if you go for Hajj, you can pay people to carry the elderly on the Hajj. But back then,
He carried his mother on his shoulders 7 times around the Kaaba. One time it would tire the most energetic of people. Carries his mother, does the entire tawaf 7 times. Carries her from Safa to Marwa. Takes her from Mecca all the way to Arafat, Muzdalifah, Mina, all the way back. Again, today you have trains and buses and the high-speed trains that go back and forth. He does all of this with his mother on his shoulders. He comes to the Imam and asks the Imam. He says, Ya ibn Rasulillah, O son of the Messenger of God, I've gone for the Hajj, carried my mom on my shoulders. Have I fulfilled her rights as a mother upon me? You'd think, well, obviously, you've done so much for your mother. The Imam came back with a powerful statement. He says, you know when you're in your cradle and she rocked you one time to try to get you to sleep? He says, all that you've done doesn't even recompense for one rocking of your cradle. SubhanAllah, can you imagine? One rocking of the cradle to put a child to sleep. How much effort does it take from a mother? One finger, you can push the cradle. But the Imam says, all that you've done on that one Hajj doesn't even repay back that one action. So imagine everything else our mothers do. They carry us in their womb. They deliver us in difficulties. They feed us from the milk that Allah has provided to them. They take care of us. They see us off to school. When we go to a new school, they might walk to us to the front door. They'll see us through every stage of our life till we get married, till we have our own children. And then, unfortunately, some of us have the audacity to insult our mothers, to disrespect our fathers, to mock them, to call them names, to forget about them, to put them up in an old folks' home, in a senior's home, as we do in these societies. And maybe on the day of Eid, we'll go and see our mother or father at the senior's home and maybe bring them some baklava or some sweets and say, Mom, it's the day of Eid. Here's some sweets for you to eat. Meanwhile, they're in a home eating God knows what, not being able to pray, not being able to read Quran, not being able to come to the majlis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And all of that they did for us, we throw it out the window because now we're married, we have our family, we have our career, we have our vacations to take, we have our beach resorts to go to. And so, brothers and sisters, we have to realize the role that our mother and father have played in our lives and continue to make for us. Just the one dua that our mother makes for us, who knows how much that is worth in the light, in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. In Ayah 191 of Surah Al Imran, we find that Allah states some attributes for those who possess intellect. In the words of Quran, those who remember Allah while standing, sitting, and lying on their sides reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. Such people are considered to be wise and of wisdom, because in any moment and in any situation, they consider Allah in their lives. Allah, through this verse, is also admiring the true possessors of intellect. In fact, in the view of Allah, the true possessors of intellect are those who see the signs of Allah everywhere and confess that these are all created ones by Allah.
در اوصاف امیرالمومنین علیه السلام نوشتند که وقتی که از خواب بلند می‌شدند.
It is mentioned in history that every day when Imam Ali alayhi salam wakes up in the midnight for tahajjud prayer, he used to read verses 190 and 191 of Surah Al-Imran of the Quran. Through these verses of the Quran, Imam Ali alayhi salam could be more attentive towards the signs of Allah around himself. Also, the late Mirza Jawad Agha Maliki Tabrizi, the outstanding Shia mystic, has suggested his students to read these verses of the Holy Quran, especially when they wake up during midnight. He even advised the people to do this before taking wudu or ablution, because this recitation of the verses will prepare your hearts for midnight and morning prayers. Therefore, ayahs like these refer to the importance of remembrance of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khalav Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is a poem sung to the river Araz or Aras, which ran through the north of Iran about a couple of hundred years ago. Today, it is the waterline dividing Iran and what used to be its ultra-north provinces. And that is how a poem struck discord. It's a reminder of exactly that separation, and it was recited by Turkish President Erdogan at a Baku parade, a victory parade celebrating a ceasefire agreement between Armenia and the Republic of Azerbaijan, an agreement that allowed Azerbaijan to reclaim control over broad swathes of Nagorno-Karabakh and surrounding lands. Now, how did it get there, and why did Erdogan recite that particular poem in celebration? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Today's map portrays an Iran bordering all three, Turkey, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. So when decades-long fighting reignited in September between Armenia and Azerbaijan, the war spilled into Iran by proximity alone. On top of it all, Azerbaijan gained the upper hand, partly because with Turkey, it stationed at Iran's borders both its archenemy Israel and Takfiri Syrian terrorists. So the way Turkey helped was no favor to Iran, and why it was so eager to help Azerbaijan was questionable. Mr. Parkayin was ambassador to the Republic of Azerbaijan. He shared his thoughts with us at his souvenir-packed house.
This poem directly provokes ethnic sentiments and questions the territorial integrity of the Islamic Republic of Iran, while promoting a kind of pan-Azerism and, in Mr. Erdogan's own words, pan-Turkism. After Mr. Erdogan recited the poem, sensitivities arose in Iran.
Azerbaijan is an Azeri Turkish-speaking republic ripped away from Azeri mainland, which is Iran's northwesternmost province today. So when Turkey's first man sang a song of separation between the two Azerbaijans, it sounded like he was calling for Iran's Azerbaijan to pull away to join its long-lost sister, the Republic of Azerbaijan, and then Big Brother Turkey, forming a pan-Turkic alliance. Iran wouldn't claim being Big Brother to its long-lost former provinces and Khanates. So why would Turkey do so, or did it? Turkey explained Mr. Erdogan's mistake, as in he must have misunderstood the poem. I asked Mr. Parkayin what he thought the Turkish president meant. What do you